We turn once again this evening to the book of Job, and we continue to consider in these early chapters. We have looked at the opening two chapters so far, and we have seen the narrative of the beginning of Job's sufferings and the reasons lying behind this terrible affliction that came upon Job. We have seen how his sufferings increase when he is afflicted personally with some disfiguring and very serious sickness, and we find him increasingly isolated from his fellow men. He's sitting outside on the town rubbish tip or the manure pile. His wife is alienated from him. She simply seems to have very little sympathy for him and no conception that he might in fact recover. Her outlook is gloomy and pessimistic and most unhelpful. And his three friends who come to sympathize with him, to comfort him, they remain silent at the sight of their friend Job. And this raises all kinds of issues, as we have seen, concerning the suffering of this present time, because the book of Job is a book about suffering seen through the eyes of the suffering of this one man, Job. And we know that it was Satan's assault upon him. We know that Satan was given permission by God, and Satan is a tool, so to speak, and used in God's purposes. And this is made clear in the book of Job in the opening chapters. Well, we have been looking at these chapters. We come now to the third chapter, and we're going to look at this chapter in its entirety, because in Job chapter 3 we have the beginning of the main part of the book, right through to the end of chapter 37. The opening two chapters form a kind of prologue, and the final chapters in the book of Job form a kind of conclusion, an epilogue to the book. The main themes and thoughts between Job and his friends are worked out in a series of dialogues. Conversation: Job speaks, one of his friends speaks, Job replies, his friends reply. That's the outworking of the narrative, and most of the chapters in the book of Job are taken up with speeches, different cycles of speeches. And Job begins this series of cycles of speeches. When we read this chapter 3, this chapter has been politely described as Job's complaint or Job's lamentation. And I say politely because Job lets an outburst come forth in this chapter. And it is a complaint, it is a lamentation, it is language that we probably would never have expected if all we had was the first two chapters telling us about Job. We would never have thought in our wildest dreams that a man who is described as the most righteous man in all the earth, and a man who, when he was afflicted and he had lost his possessions, said, "The Lord has given, the Lord has taken away, blessed be the name of the Lord," and who again, when his wife told him to curse God and die, told her that she was speaking foolishly, and shall we not receive evil from the hand of the Lord as well as good? And these are the only two places where we find Job uttering any words hitherto in the book of Job. And then when he opens his mouth in chapter 3, it's almost as if we're in the presence of an entirely different individual. We would never have expected Job to say the kinds of things that he says. But nonetheless, this is what he does say according to the record of his anguish. The first thing that we want to emphasize in this speech or lamentation or complaint of Job is that Job is the first one to break the silence. We saw at the end of chapter 2, you remember, how his friends came to him and they sat down, and we're told they sat down with him upon the ground 7 days and seven nights, and none spoke a word unto him. And as I mentioned, one of the commentators, Delitzsch, godly Delitzsch, makes the point it'd be very good if they did say something to him, and it's a real pity that they didn't. because maybe Job would not have said the kinds of things that he begins to say if someone had spoken a kind word to him and given him some understanding that they at least sympathized and understood in a measure the terrible tragedy that was afflicting him. And so there is a total silence, and we don't know how long this silence lasted. We're told 7 days and seven nights, but it may have gone on for longer. It may have only been for a week, but that surely would be long enough for Job's friends to be sitting there just watching him in his anguish and saying nothing to him. And Job saying nothing to them, just looking at them mutely and with great pain, no doubt, written all over his face. And it may well be that as Job has been watching his friends, he has begun to understand some of their thoughts concerning him. And he may well, as we do from time to time, we can almost see the way people, by their very reaction to us, we can see, in a sense, what they're thinking. And it may well be that Job's friends were beginning to express some of the not only the misunderstanding and confusion that they had, but a kind of increasing enmity. Because there's no doubt that when they do begin to speak, it seems as if they're not on Job's sides at all. They begin to accuse him of self-righteousness, hypocrisy, secret sin, and they try to tell Job a thing or two about theology, about the Lord, and what they say is right in the abstract, but it's not right in terms of its application to Job. They are theologically, one might say, immaculate. It's evident that they are godly men. Job is a godly man, and it's unlikely that Job would make close friends with people who were not godly. Job would understand that there is on earth the communion of saints, and therefore we have to give these three friends the benefit of the doubt. They are good men, but they're out of their depth, and this is the problem, and this is the point. And they know their theology, that God doesn't normally deal with people like this, and God rewards the righteous and punishes sinners, and that's good theology. In a sense, it's good enough, I suppose, to get by with. It's not entirely the whole story, but when they begin to speak, they begin to speak like that, as if Job somehow or other has deserved everything that has come upon him. And a great deal of the book of Job is taken up with Job protesting. He's not going to start confessing sins that he hasn't committed, and he's not going to begin to invent some sort of sins that he knows perfectly well he has not been guilty of. And it may be that when Job finally does break the silence, that he's already aware these three men are not only not sympathetic, but they're, in a sense, against him. And there's going to be very little comfort coming from these three friends of Job. So we're told that Job opens his mouth, and he just lets go, as it were. And we're told here that Job opened his mouth and cursed his day, and we'll comment on that in a moment. But the important thing is this, that Job doesn't bottle up within himself his feelings. There is a kind of piety, and a great deal of it comes from Puritanism, actually, which seems to imply that we've got to reason out things, we've got to understand the ways of God and not to question the Almighty. And when God's people are afflicted, we can stand it because we are God's people. And you find that there is a kind of piety which is more to do with heathen stoicism than to do with biblical religion. We find in the Bible the people of God, they are quite emotional people. The psalmists, they don't hesitate to tell us how they weep. And Abraham, he makes no hiding of the fact that he weeps over his dead. Our Lord Jesus Christ wept at the grave of his friend, and it may well be that some people who were there would be embarrassed by that. And I'm not saying that we are to let ourselves go on every single occasion, but the Bible does say there's a time to weep and there's a time to rejoice and there's a time to show our feelings in the matter and express what's on our mind, just to say what we think about things. And so when Job opens his mouth, he's actually being very honest. He's not going to play piety and pretend that all is right and the ways of the Lord are past his understanding, but he will submit and not at all. Job is going to start complaining, and he wants to ask certain questions because Job has big questions in his mind and he wants to know why this is happening to him. And he's going to make it very clear that as far as he's concerned, it would be better to be dead than to be in this condition where you're absolutely alone, a social outcast, spiritually depressed, and physically quite sick with no hope of recovery, apparently. And even your closest friends and family just don't seem to understand the problems that are afflicting your life. So Job here is not going to bottle all this up and pretend to be living, as it were, a spiritual victory. He's not. This is something that we've got to understand as Christians. And there are those books on devotion that came out of, certain brands of Christianity. And quite frankly, I don't think they're very helpful when it comes to dealing with the problems of life, because they present a kind of ideal which is not true to the flesh and blood reality of the problems that afflict us in this present life. And Job here, therefore, he doesn't bottle this up, he just lets loose. And everything that Job is saying in this chapter are truthful sayings. Job is not exaggerating how he feels. He's not, as it were, going beyond. He is simply saying, this is the way that I feel about it. And he's not particularly, as far as I can understand, trying to elicit sympathy. He's not painting the worst possible picture in order that his friends will come round to his way of thinking, because it's evident from what they say that they don't come round to his way of thinking. And when all the discussions and sermons that they would want to preach to Job have been said and done, it's obvious that they've never come round to Job's way of thinking. They just don't understand what Job is saying, and they don't understand why he is suffering. And they say many good things, but everything they say is irrelevant as far as the situation concerning Job's affliction is concerned. So Job doesn't bottle things up and grin and bear it. He lets loose. And he tells his friend what he thinks about life. Now, the chapter is divided basically into a number of sections. There are different. Some say it's four sections. Some of the commentators say it's three sections. I tend to think it's three sections. And in the first 10 verses of this chapter 3, we find Job complaining about the day of his birth. And he cursed his day. And when you look at the language from verse number 2 to verse number 10, it's very strong language. He is actually cursing the day that he was ever born. Job is wishing that he had never seen the light of day because of what his experience is now. It's interesting, of course, that in this whole chapter and in the chapters that follow, when we find Job speaking, we never find him cursing God. He's cursing life, and he's cursing the day of his birth. And he's wishing the night in which he was conceived had never taken place, and the day of his birth had never taken place. He is at a terribly low point, and he actually wishes that he had never been born. Now, that's how he feels about it. Now, I'm sure that there are times in life when we sometimes wonder if it was good for us to be born. There are many of God's people, maybe not us, because we're all pretty healthy and wealthy and wise and that kind of thing, and we're surrounded and cushioned by comforts. But there are some of God's people in this world, and life is very, very hard for them. And they don't have friends in the way that we have. They don't have the amenities. They are outcasts, and they just don't know why it is that God is dealing with them in the way that he is dealing with them. And we've got to be sympathetic to these people, because they are questioning the very reason of their own existence. And they may well have regrets, and they may wish that they were no longer in this present world. You notice that when Job, as we're going to see, longs for death, it's not that he longs for extinction, because Job, as we know from the later verses of this chapter, he believes in life after death. People have rest. And it's not that he wants to be extinguished when life is over. He wants to be at rest from the troubles of this present time. But Job is not the only one who speaks like this. If you go to the prophet Jeremiah, I'm sure those of you who have looked up commentaries will remember that sad episode in the life of the prophet Jeremiah in chapter 20. And in chapter 20 in Jeremiah, I would refer you to it, at verse number 7, the prophet Jeremiah, he's been preaching for a number of years. People haven't been listening to him. In fact, things have been getting worse. He's been put into prison. He has been delivered from prison. His ministry continues, and there's still no blessing, and there's still no revival taking place in Jerusalem. The Chaldeans are gathering round. Jeremiah, you remember, in the first chapter, was called by the Lord to the prophetic ministry. The Lord had said he would put his word in his mouth. Jeremiah said, well, I'm too young. And the Lord said, no, I'll be with you. And I will put words in your mouth and you will speak. So Jeremiah began to speak. And he began to do what God told him to do. And nothing happened except difficulties, criticism, rejection. He was hated by the people. He was accused of undermining the morale of the army. And undermining the state, so to speak. He was accused of being treasonous because there were these false prophets who were saying peace, peace, and there was no peace. And Jeremiah was becoming more and more discouraged, disillusioned with his own ministry, more and more unhappy, and more confused. And there came the point when he wanted to pack up preaching and just leave the ministry. And he says this at verse number 7. O Lord, thou hast deceived me. Now, this is Jeremiah the prophet speaking. He's speaking to God. He's saying to God, you've deceived me. And I was deceived. Thou art stronger than I and hast prevailed. I am in derision daily. Everyone mocks me. For since I spoke, I cried out. Here is Jeremiah saying, I've been preaching faithfully your word. I've been doing what you tell me. And it's cost, there's been no blessing, there's no converts. The people are not changing, they're just as idolatrous as they ever were. Nothing's happening except that I'm getting more and more discouraged, more and more lonely, and more the object of public mockery, and indeed enmity. I cried out, I cried violence and spoil, because the word of the Lord was made a reproach to me and a derision daily. And then here is Jeremiah. Then I said, I will not make mention of him nor speak any more in his name. Jeremiah sings, I am resigning from the ministry. And then he says this, well, I can't really. But his word was in my heart as a burning fire shut up in my bones. And I was weary with forbearing and could not stay. So Jeremiah realized that the word of the Lord had been planted in him. And that as long as he lived in this world, he was going to have to be a preacher of the word of the Lord. And then if you go to the end of the chapter, Jeremiah speaks as to how he really feels about his life. At verse number 14, cursed be the day wherein I was born. Let not the day wherein my mother bore me be blessed. Cursed be the man who brought tidings to my father, saying, a man child is born unto thee, making him very glad. Let that man be as the cities which the Lord overthrew and repented not. Let him hear the cry in the morning and the shouting at noontide, because he slew me not from the womb, or that my mother might have been my grave and her womb to be always great with me. Wherefore came I forth? Why did I come forth out of the womb? To see labor and sorrow, that my days should be consumed with shame. Now here is another man of God, and he may well be quoting in a kind of interpretive way the language that's in the book of Job. It may be that he knew of Job's utterances in chapter 3, and because the language of Jeremiah is very similar to the language of Job. But here are two eminently godly men, and they've reached this point of discouragement and isolation. And they simply are saying, well, I would rather never have been born than to have experienced this. If they had ever imagined that this would come upon them, never in their wildest dreams would they have thought that God would have treated them like this. And this is what Job is expressing, and this is what Jeremiah is expressing. And in these first 10 chapters, Job is speaking very, very strongly. And he is cursing the day in which he was ever born, the night that he was conceived. Better, he says, never to have existed than to experience. Now, there's a certain truthfulness, in a sense, in what Job is saying. Because Job is suffering in a way that is extreme, it is unique, and it is apparently meaningless. So that's the first thing that Job is complaining about in his lament. And then from verse 11 to 19, we have Job, as it were, quarreling with life, as one of the commentators puts it. He asks a series of questions from verse number 11. Why did I not from the womb Why died I not from the womb? Why did I not give up the ghost when I came out of the belly? And verse number 12. Why did the knees prevent me? Why did my mother allow me to come to the birth? In verse, we have an implication in verse number 16, or as the hidden untimely birth, I had not been as infants which never saw the light. And at verse number 23, where he continues this questioning, which rejoice and are glad when they can find it. Why is light given to a man whose way is hid and whose ways God has hedged in? So here Job is asking a lot of questions about life. Why was I allowed to be born? And why was I allowed to be born into this? This is what Job is saying. And then from verse number 20, and to the end of the chapter, Job actually wants to die. He says, wherefore is light given to him that is in misery, and life unto the bitter in soul, which long for death? There may well come a time in the life of the most eminent of saints where we actually long to die. The Apostle Paul, you remember, he had, in a sense, this view of life, not entirely in the same context, but he did have a view of life in which he said it was better to depart and to be with Christ, which is far better. And as we're going to see in another occasion, Job knew that his Redeemer lived and that there was life beyond death, and that the death of the body was not going to be the end of Job. There was blessedness. And he knew that one day he was going to stand upon the earth and see God. Even after the worms had eaten his body and his body had moldered into dust once again. So this is the complaint that Job is making in this particular chapter. It is a cursing of the day of his birth. He's got a lot of questions as to why he's being allowed to experience this. And he actually wants to die. He is longing for that rest and that peace where he says that all the sufferings of this world are going to be over. But then you notice something very strange. There is a clue in this chapter why it is that Job is so speaking as he does. And the clue is in verse number 25, where Job says this, "For the thing which I greatly feared has come upon me, and that which I was afraid of has come unto me." Now, the scholars differ as to the precise wording of this, but our translation has got the meaning of it fair enough. Job is saying there is something which I've always feared in my life, and this something that I feared more than everything else, it's finally come upon me. Now, the scholars differ as to what this thing is that Job feared, and there are some interesting comments. There are some which are unworthy of Job, and there are some which, there is one particularly which I think is most worthy of the good man Job. When Job is saying, "The thing that I feared has come upon me," we're not to understand surely, simply, that Job is saying, "Well, I was afraid of losing all my money, all my animals, all my possessions." Now, that would be a reasonable fear. People who are wealthy in this world tend to have a fear of losing their wealth, and they do every conceivable thing to make sure that their goods are intact. There's a kind of a fear of losing the wealth that they've accumulated. It's a real, it's a natural, it is almost a universal fear. And it would be easy, therefore, to assume that Job, because he was such a wealthy man and used to the privileges and the pleasures, no doubt, and the choices in life that riches can give to people, that he would fear of losing this, what we might call today, the quality of life to which he had become accustomed. And there are those who take that view, that Job was afraid, and that in this moment of extremity, the real heart of Job is beginning to reveal itself, that he is basically a man who, he will serve God and enjoy God's good gifts, and the moment that God takes it from him, Job begins to question God. I'm not convinced by that argument personally, because God himself speaks very highly of Job in the beginning and at the end of the book of Job. God is commending and applauding Job. So that is not a way to understand what it was that Job was fearing. And then there are those who say, well, he surely must have feared the loss of his children. Now, that's a natural fear. All of us, I'm sure, have that fear. Whenever our children go on a journey or whatever, I'm sure we commend them to the Lord in prayer. And we do know from chapter 1 in verse number 5 there, that Job made sacrifices and offered prayers on behalf of his children because he was concerned for them, lest they would sin against the Lord and perhaps suddenly been cut off. And there is no doubt that when Job lost his children in these sad calamities, the shock must have been almost unbearable, and the pain in his paternal heart must have been just so hard to bear. He would be a broken-hearted man, surely, as we say. And there are those who say, well, this was what was fearing in Job's heart, that all his life he was so tied up with his family that he just couldn't bear to lose his darling children. Now, again, I think that is not really getting to the heart of what Job is talking about. If my understanding is right, Job is speaking about not the loss of his wealth and goods in this world or the loss of his children. He is speaking of the loss of his fellowship with God, because God is the most important thing to Job. And the one thing that Job would fear would be that in any way he would lose this sweet fellowship. Those who know and who love and who desire to know God even more, he becomes most precious to them. And the one thing that we fear, if we are Christians, surely the one thing that we fear more than anything else in our existence is that God should turn against us, that we should in some way be cast off from God. Because you see, we take God seriously. Job is a serious-minded man. And as far as Job is concerned, God is not just an idea that you can take it or leave it. Job knows the issues of human life. And he knows that the ultimate issue of human life is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. And Job is undergoing an experience in which he is beginning to wonder whether God is turning against him, and whether God is in fact becoming his enemy, as he says later on. He is losing the sense of God's presence. He has lost already the evidences, the physical, temporal evidences of God's goodness to him, as we were emphasizing last Wednesday. In the Old Testament, the blessings of life are equated with the blessings of the Lord. And as far as the people of Israel are concerned, and in these ancient times, to be, as it were, well provided for and such like things in this world, these were tokens that God was for his people. And signs that God was against his people would be that the people of God would become poor, their children would die, they would not have children, their animals would not be fertile and fruitful, their fields would not produce good crops, they would be fleeing before their enemies. In other words, there would be evidences that God was either for them or against them. And there's quite a number of places in the Old Testament where, for example, when we're told of how the army of Israel went out to battle, they would win the battle because the Lord was with them. In other words, these victories in war were evidences that the Lord was with them. And defeat in battle, in quite a number of places in the Old Testament, is the Lord was not with them. And so there is this idea. And it's not entirely a false idea. It doesn't cover every case, but it certainly is something that surely covers Job's case. And so here we have Job, and he is saying there is something that has been fundamental to his thinking. God is important to him. The natural man, the man who doesn't take God seriously, he doesn't mind if God seems to turn against him, because God's not important to him. The natural man doesn't care one way or the other, really. He's quite happy to live without God and to keep God out of his life. But Job's not like that. Job wants God near him, and Job wants to be near God. And the interesting thing is, at the end of the book of Job, we find that God gives to Job again tokens of his favor and of his blessing. He gives Job twice as much as he had before. And Job lived full of days, 100-odd years more, and saw his children to the fourth generation. So this is the kind of thing. Job is bereft not only of temporal goods, bad enough as that is, but in his own soul, Job is feeling desolated. And there is absolutely no one who seems to understand what he is actually suffering. The problems with Job is that he's no longer sure, as once he was, that God loves him. He is still clinging to God. Even though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. But he's not so sure that God is for him now. He doesn't know why God seems to be dealing with him in this unjust way. Now, you and I have, at times, in our little ups and downs of life, we've all had these kinds of experiences. I'm sure every Christian believer who is concerned to know and to enjoy the presence of the Lord, I'm sure there are times when, for a variety of reasons, we have lost that consciousness. And it has been a desolating experience. And we were commenting on Sunday morning on our Lord Jesus Christ, you remember, when he seems to have, for that moment, lost the sense of God's presence with him. I know that you always hear me. He is always with me. And yet on that cry on Calvary's cross, we find a desolation in the heart of Christ, the utter loneliness where even God himself is no longer bringing to him the comfort as once he had become accustomed to it. So there is this real experience. So Job here is speaking of a real dread. And the worst thing that could happen to Job has actually come. And this is what he's speaking about, and this is why he speaks. I wish I'd never been born to experience, because he is taking God seriously. Now, these words of Job, on the face of it, they seem to be foolish words. They seem to be words that not only do his friends not understand, but they are words that seem to anger his friends. Because Job, when he speaks, he gives them opportunity to misunderstand him. Rather than entering into a sympathetic understanding of what Job is really driving at, and here is anguish that is pouring out of this bereft man, they immediately begin to accuse him of being wise in his own eyes, self-righteous, hypocritical, harboring secret sins, and all kinds of things. And so the words of Job are straight from the heart of a man who is expressing the deepest desolation in life, and he is hiding nothing. Now, these words may well be foolish words. I'm not going to try to defend Job. The Lord will defend Job, and God will be Job's advocate. But let us try to understand that what Job is uttering in these words is not the normative, settled attitude of Job. These are hasty words, we might say. Yes, they are hasty words. We're not going to say that Job is right in everything that he says, or has a right to question every kind of experience that he's undergoing. But it is understandable in the circumstances that Job, as a man of flesh and blood, should feel like this. And we've got to understand that this is not Job normal. This is Job abnormal. This is suffering Job. This is not Job who is enjoying the good things of life and the sweet fellowship with the Lord. This is Job decimated, desolated, and spiritually very, very low. So we mustn't take Job's words, as Job's friends apparently were doing, and take them as saying, well, this is a real expression of Job's settled attitude to life. It's not. Now, there are times when we can speak out of turn. There are times when I say foolish things, as you well know. And there are times when you say foolish things, as I well know. And we all know it. And we all, at times, we have our ups and downs. And there are times when we're sad. There are times when we are hasty. There are times when we, quite frankly, say things that they would have been better left unsaid. The point is, we do say them. But that does not mean to say that we're to be judged. Our character is to be judged by these hasty moments, these abnormal moments. If I, for example, I don't want to give myself as an example, but ourselves as an example. If, in fact, supposing we are noted for being fairly consistent, and then we do something or say something in a hasty moment when we're confused or hurt or damaged or whatever, we're not to be judged by that hasty moment. We're to be judged by the tenor of our life rather than the abnormalities of life. And this is what we've got to understand about Job. Job here is expressing real human suffering. And he's asking some pretty deep questions here. But he is a man, we've got to understand, he's not always like this. Job, throughout the rest of his life, when the Lord blesses, he's not going to curse the day of his birth again. Job probably had never cursed the day of his birth before. But in this moment, he is not thinking straight, because he is too wounded physically and in every other way. He is a wounded creature. And wounded creatures become, they do things and they flee into corners and they say things that we ought not to say. So let's not be harsh in judgments about Christian people who may well be suffering a great deal, and they come to us and they want a bit of sympathy, and we say to them, as sometimes, bear up and be like a man. Well, Job's like a man. Job's a man who's suffering, sitting on a muck heap, but he's a man, and he's a man who is needing a great deal of sympathy. And when someone comes to us and says things that perhaps are not the wisest, perhaps not the most orthodox things that we would expect, nonetheless, let us understand their circumstances. Let us understand the hurt that's in their heart. Let us understand the anguish and the loneliness that can easily come into the life of a Christian believer. And let us understand something else, because there's more to this than meets the eye. This outburst of Job is a real outburst, all right. But we've got to understand it's not only because of Job's friends who don't understand him, Job's pain that he doesn't understand himself, his wife's lack of sympathy. There's something else in the experience of Job that you and I know about, but he doesn't know about it, and that's the assault of Satan. Job here is a man who is a prime target for Satan. We know that from chapter 1 and 2. And as one of the commentators puts it rather well, I think, this whole business of how Satan can afflict a Christian mind has perhaps not been sufficiently explored in Christian apologetics and understanding, Christian counseling. Because sometimes in counseling situations you get stock answers, just like Job's friends, and it's possible to give all the sort of answers we've read in books somewhere and not understand that maybe here is an individual who is experiencing what the Apostle Paul calls the wiles of the devil. You and I are exhorted in Ephesians chapter 6 from verse 10 onwards to be strong in the Lord. And the reason we're to put on all the armor of God is because there is such a thing as Satan, the devil. And he has wiles, he has methods. And these methods are well tried and they're well proven and they seem to work. And we are easily tempted. And he understands perhaps where our weak points are. And we've got to understand too that when Job is suffering, right through the book of Job, when the whole of his suffering, he is at every single point being assaulted by Satan. We don't hear any more of Satan in the book of Job after chapter 2. But that doesn't mean to say he's not there. The whole of Job's sufferings is because Satan is there. Satan is the one who is afflicting Job. That's what we're told in chapter 1. I have given him into your hands, says the Lord, and you will afflict him. You will not slay him. You will afflict him. And here is Job being afflicted by Satan and the fiery darts and the wiles of the devil and those dark thoughts that we have about God. And all these kinds of afflictions that come to Christian people, where do these blasphemous thoughts come from? Go to chapter 6 in the book of Job, the opening verses. Job answered, he's answering one of his friends who has been speaking out of turn. But Job answered and said, "Oh, that my grief were thoroughly weighed and my calamity laid in the balances together, for now it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. My burdens are heavier than the sand of the sea," he says. "Therefore my words are swallowed up, for the arrows of the Almighty are within me. The poison whereof drinketh up my spirit, the terrors of God do set themselves into array against me." Well, it's not the arrows of the Almighty that are in Job, it's the arrows of Satan. But you see, Job has got dark thoughts concerning God, because Satan is afflicting Job. And Satan's temptations, the Bible makes it clear, in all the temptations that we read, it's all deception. The God of this world blinds the minds of those who do not believe the gospel. The God of this world can darken the mind of a Christian. Satan deceived Eve. He actually deceived her. Our Lord Jesus Christ, in the adverse circumstances of the desert, was assaulted by Satan. If you are the Son of God, if, always the doubt, you see, casting aspersions upon God. The very first time that Satan opens his mouth, it is an aspersion against it. Has God said, planting seeds of doubt in the minds of God's people against God himself? And the Bible is very realistic concerning this. And this is what's happening to Job. Job is being afflicted by Satan, and therefore he is speaking out of turn, we might say. But Job is confused, he's depressed, he is discouraged. And Job, quite frankly, is not thinking straight, because God has given Job into the hands of Satan to afflict him. And Job's affliction is not only a physical thing, it's a mental thing. It's a spiritual thing. And we've got to understand that sometimes Christian people, they need not theological lectures of how to be orthodox and to grin and bear up in the adversities of life, but they need little comforting words and maybe prayers and maybe a handshake and maybe a cup of tea and a sandwich or something like that, and just a companionship that recognizes we share and we sympathize with your deep darkness and your sorrow. And that is what Job is experiencing. That's what he needs, and that's what he's not getting from anybody. And it seems that he's not even at this point getting it from God. He's going to get it later on, but at this point there is no light on the dark horizons of Job's experience. But before we close, there's one final point I want to emphasize. Not only Job's utterances and the reason that he speaks is because the one thing he feared above all has come upon him, the assault by Satan, but also Job is not being destroyed in all of this. And this is an outburst which expresses anguish and pain and desolation, but there's no cursing of God in it. Later on, he becomes more strong in words that are foolish. But at the end of the day, Job is a man who is kept by the power of God. Satan can do so much to God's people. He can do a great deal. But at the end of the day, we're not in the hands of Satan, we're in the hands of God. And the reason that Job doesn't commit suicide, he never even contemplates suicide. He wants to die, but he's not going to commit suicide. His wife says, die. Job says, well, I'm not going to slay myself. Can a Christian commit suicide? Of course a Christian commits suicide. Because we're not thinking straight. Suicide is not the unpardonable sin. Some might say, well, no murder. Yes, we know these texts too. It is possible for a Christian believer to become so dark in his understanding that life perhaps becomes so unbearable that he will end it all. And I think that there are well-attested cases of such a thing. We must not assume automatically that a man who commits suicide is destined for a fiery judgment. I remember a very famous sermon preached by a very famous preacher, preaching at the death of a man, a Christian evangelist who had committed suicide. And this preacher put it rather well, I felt. He said, sometimes a sheep may go over a cliff, but it's still a sheep. It may well go over a cliff as a sheep. And that's the way I think we should deal with it. But the point is this, not to be sidetracked. Job is in God's hand. And God is not going to tempt Job beyond which Job is able to bear. And God is going to see Job through. God is faithful according to the scriptures. It's the same with all of us. We are all of us kept by the power of God through faith unto salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time. Job is indestructible. Satan can do whatever he pleases. Job at the end is in God's hand. God's people are always indestructible. And there are little hints through the book of Job that even in these darkest hours, Job still is clinging to faith and to hope and to love. I know that my Redeemer lives. I know that you will bring me to the house of death. He knows that even if he dies, God's hand is there and God will be with him. So there are many mysteries. But here is Job. He just lets loose. And there are times when, you know, a good weep may be the best thing for us. Not grinning and bearing it, but just letting it out, showing our emotions. There's no harm in that. And Jesus wept. Job is complaining. He's got a lot to complain about. And Job is not bottling it up. And Job is not doing himself further damage by grinning and bearing and bottling it up and having a heart attack or something like that. Job is speaking as a man, and he's speaking the truth as he sees it at this time concerning his situation. There's a lot of implications, you see. We're just opening it up, you see. There are a lot of experimental religion in the experience and in the words of Job. But let us not judge Job harshly for the simple reason that God does not. May God bless his word to us.